What happens when your life-saving treatment for cancer makes you mentally ill?
It lasted 3 months that I was getting infusions of immunotherapy drugs. And by the end of this cycle, I started behaving very strangely. I was becoming more angry, acting incredibly irritated about anything and everything. And then I started losing myself in various places, in very familiar places.
That's neuroscientist Barbara Lipska. She tells her remarkable story of cancer, mental illness, and recovery in her book, The Neuroscientist Who Lost Her Mind. Then we air a clip from our 2008 interview with neuroscientist Jill Bolte Taylor about her book, My Stroke of Insight. And finally, we check in with Nation magazine correspondent Audra Lim about how farmers in Puerto Rico are building resilience and fighting climate change. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. When neuroscientist Barbara Lipska's right hand disappeared from her vision one day when she was at work, she knew something was going wrong with her brain. It turned out she had metastatic brain cancer. Remarkably, she's still here 3 years later to tell the tale in her book, The Neuroscientist Who Lost Her Mind. That's at least partly because of a radical course of immunotherapy that shrank her tumors. But the same therapy also sent her into an episode of severe mental illness with symptoms of both schizophrenia and dementia. Her memoir melds her personal story of courage and recovery with a fascinating exploration of the science behind both mental illness and how cancer treatment can bring it on. Barbara Lipska was born, raised, and educated in communist Poland and immigrated to the U.S. in 1989. She began working then at the National Institute of Mental Health and remains there today. There she became an internationally recognized leader in animal modeling of schizophrenia. In 2013, she became the director of the Human Brain Collection Corps at the NIMH. I want to welcome you, Barbara Lipska, to Writer's Voice.
Oh, I am glad that I can participate. Thank you for inviting me.
So this is a book that's both about cancer and mental illness, as well as the connection between them, and about the mental illness that you suffered as the result of a brain tumor. You were a neuroscientist in charge of the brain collection at the National Institute of Mental Health, NIMH, when something really bizarre happened. You were at work one day and suddenly noticed you couldn't see your right hand. What was going on?
That's right, and it was shocking. I couldn't believe what I was not seeing. My hand basically disappeared on the right lower corner of my visual field. At first, and I consider myself invincible, although I was diagnosed before with breast cancer and later with skin melanoma. But I still was very optimistic and worked out. And I thought, I'm very strong. I could handle all this. And all of a sudden, I have no hand to handle all this. So at first, I dismissed it as a horrible, deadly possibility that I cannot entertain. I cannot possibly even consider it because I have work to do. I have workouts to do. So I kept working, but after several hours of not seeing and faces and objects disappearing when they entered my right lower field, basically I ran to my family doctor and he examined me and he immediately thought it's in my brain. Of course, my first thought was a brain tumor, but it was too horrible to even think about it.
And it was actually metastatic melanoma. So explain to us how a melanoma that originally started behind your ear, I believe,
yes,
then went to your brain.
Melanoma is a particularly aggressive skin cancer. And it metastasizes in later stages when it's discovered in later stages. Mine was stage one, so it was initial stage. But the mole that I had behind my ear was not very small. It was perhaps the size of the nail on my pinky. But it's not considered small for melanoma. But it was still optimistic. It was stage one. So I dismissed again. I dismissed the thought that it could metastasize. And I was particularly terrified of melanoma because my first husband died of it in 1985. So I had a very personal experience with it. But it did metastasize, nevertheless. And, well, I knew it. I knew it all along that it likes to metastasize into the brain, particularly. It can metastasize to any organ, but it likes the brain. And the hypothesis, or maybe it's more than a hypothesis, but I'm not that, you know, good in cancer field, that it likes the environment of the brain because it is similar to very early to the environment of very early embryo development skins, so embryo, fetal, and early development of the skin. So skin and brain are similar in terms of composition, and that's why it likes to be there. It is particularly horrible because brain, as we know, is the most important organ that we have. It is all that defines us. No brain, no life.
Speaking of mental illness, speaking of the brain, actually, your specialty is schizophrenia, but you're not a psychiatrist. So what's the connection between schizophrenia and neuroscience?
So there needs to be done a lot of basic science to understand how the human brain works, how any brain works. So I started my work on the brain in rats. I was figuring out on the molecular level and neuroanatomical level what particular structures do, how the rats behave if you damage this or that brain region. And then many of these findings can be translated into the human science. So before we understand human mental illnesses, we need to understand first how the normal brain works. And this is what I've been working on my entire professional career.
You made a discovery that's actually called the Lipska model. What was that discovery?
So the hypothesis there was that very early in rats' life, if we damage the hippocampus, it will not any longer receive prefrontal cortical connections, which are extremely important for the behavior of these rats. And I discovered, together with my collaborators from NIMH and my boss, that if you damage these connections very early in life, rats will grow onto relatively normal rats until they hit puberty. And this was bizarre. We didn't expect it to find, but this is exactly when mental illness, in particular schizophrenia, emerges in human life. There's no rat schizophrenia. There may be some symptoms that are reminiscent of those described in patients, in human patients, but those symptoms emerged in these rats around the time of puberty. So this was very interesting to many, many investigators and investigators in drug companies who immediately started working on better drugs that would address this particular abnormality.
So there's a kind of a connection, you're saying, you know, possibly between this discovery you made in rats and the fact that often schizophrenia appears in humans.
That's right.
At puberty.
Yes.
So you mentioned the prefrontal cortex. I didn't even know rats had a prefrontal cortex, but we certainly know that people do. Tell us what the prefrontal cortex does.
Prefrontal cortex in humans does many, many, many different things. And in rats, actually, there is prefrontal cortex. It is much less developed. Frontal cortex in general in rats is very smooth. Prefrontal cortex is small and smooth, but it's located in a similar parts of the brain, that is the very front part of the brain. What it does, many different functions. It was very long time ago discovered that no other brain region is responsible for so many functions. And it includes in people, emotions, insight, memory, especially short-term memory, inhibition, executive function, almost everything that makes us human.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Barbara Lipska about her memoir, The Neuroscientist Who Lost Her Mind. So your metastatic melanoma, there were several tumors in the brain, but the location of your largest tumor was in the prefrontal cortex. So now tell us, what began to happen and why? Because, you know, when you couldn't see your hand, that's basically a neurological symptom. But in this book, you talk about the mental illness that you began to suffer. So what brought that on?
Okay, so when I had this incident with the disappearing hand, I went to the neurosurgeon at Dana-Farber. And I had surgery into my brain. So he removed that tumor. But all of us, my family and I, knew that it's not the end of the story. You can remove one melanoma tumor, but it's obvious that others will be growing. The others were radiated that I had at the time, but they were growing because in a month or in a few weeks, I had three more that were radiated. It was obvious that they would be growing because radiation doesn't prevent them throughout the brain. So we had to come up with some other therapy, not surgery and not radiation, although I had all these also. So we poured through the scientific literature, talked to doctors, consulted wherever we could go to the best institutions, and we're very lucky because my daughter works at Yale, I work at NIH. My sister works at Dana-Farber in Boston. So we are really covering a lot of ground between the members of our family. And we came up with basically the only viable solution, that is immunotherapy. Immunotherapy was developed initially for melanoma. But at the time that I had these tumors, which was the beginning of 2015, it was only used for tumors, systemic tumors, so outside the brain. It was not thought that it can help tumors in the brain. So I was enrolled in a clinical trial, and that clinical trial was supposed to find out whether tumors in the brain can be obliterated or killed by immunotherapy. Unfortunately, what happened... So we can talk about what immunotherapy is, but it lasted 3 months that I was getting infusions of immunotherapy drugs. And by the end of this cycle of 3 months, I started behaving very strangely, more and more strange. And it was gradual. It didn't happen like from one day to another. It happened over weeks. I was becoming more angry, acting incredibly irritated about anything and everything. I was yelling at my grandsons, yelling at my husband, and then I started losing myself in various places, in very familiar places. So this was the alert signal to my family that something very strange is going on, and it's probably happening in my brain. But they didn't know that I was in immunotherapy, which was supposed to cure me and not increase the problems in the brain.
So you began to show symptoms that, some of which were very familiar to me. I took care of my mother before she died, and she had a terrible fall with a traumatic brain injury. She had a couple of other vascular problems, heart failure and stuff. I don't think she ever had Alzheimer's, but there was definitely disinhibition. There was paranoia. She thought I was trying to kill her, even though I loved her very, very much. And yet there were also times that she was completely lucid, had it totally together. She lost the ability to use simple technological things. She couldn't figure out how to make a phone work. And yet I could have a great conversation with her. So how does this patchwork kind of symptoms work? Because they were true for you too. You were carrying on your full-time job.
And this makes it so difficult to pinpoint what's wrong with the person. When one day my husband was in tears and the other one, I came back from the swimming pool and I was so happy and everything was okay. So he thought, okay, it was just one time. Maybe I was just, you know, after all, I was handed a death sentence. So my family and my friends thought I'm just very, very stressed. It is very difficult to understand why and how it happens. But it is also true of mental illness that it is not stable over a very long time. Many mental illnesses, and I'm talking here mainly about schizophrenia, but also bipolar disorder and depression, they fluctuate over time. So they change and they are also different. They are displayed differently between different people. That's why it is so difficult to study it and to find a cure, to understand mechanisms, because there's no objective one endpoint that you can target either with drugs or with some kind of other therapies, behavior therapies. All these changes, behaviors, are complex and very complicated to measure.
Your book is a fascinating study. I mean, first of all, it's a great personal story, and I want to tell our listeners, we're talking with Barbara Lipska about her book, The Neuroscientist Who Lost Her Mind, My Tale of Madness and Recovery. It's a fascinating story. It's a personal story and scientific story about cancer, but also about mental illness. So in light of what you've just said, I mean, one of the things you say is mental illnesses share a common neurobiological substrate. I wasn't sure what you meant by this, but it put me in mind of something that was recently discovered that showed that autism and attention deficit disorder have similar molecular characteristics. Is that the biological substrate you're talking about?
Yes, exactly. So you can call it mechanisms, but mechanisms at the molecular level. It may be genetic. It may be in terms of gene expression, which is the next step. Every gene produces RNA, which produces proteins. So in every of these steps, there may be some overlap between various mental illnesses. Especially, it has been studied on the level of genetics. So it is relatively easier to get blood from people with a lot of subjects. We're talking hundreds, maybe not hundreds, but definitely tens of thousands of people, and then study their gene structure in their blood. Should be the same, with some exceptions, to the gene structure in brain. In the brain, genes are expressed differently than in blood, but their structure should be the same. So in this way, investigators are showing that there is some genetic structural similarity between mental illnesses, including autism, including bipolar disorders, schizophrenia, depression, and others. We don't fully understand it. We don't fully understand what the differences are. But more and more researchers are coming up with publications showing that there are differences in genes, structural similarities in genes between different mental illnesses.
And yet you've just said that it's so, everything is different in different people. So it, there's something that's common there, but there's also something that's different.
Right. So it has been observed before by many people that personality, which is also, personality is not some kind of spiritual thing that we have inserted in our brains. It's genes working in a certain context of other genes. So it is not surprising that all these mental illnesses may manifest differently in different people because these people have different genetic makeup. They have their personalities, but their personalities equals different genetic makeup. And on top of this, there may be mutations in other genes or environmental factors affecting expression of these genes. We don't know fully. We don't fully understand what it is. But environment definitely plays a role, as well as genes.
And so a lot of people talk about brain chemistry as being what's involved with mental illness. But in your case, you had inflammation of the brain as a result of your immunotherapy. Could you explain what the whole chemicals or chemistry means and why, in your case, something that had to do with inflammation was causing these very similar problems?
So you're talking about neurotransmitters, probably, that have been for a long time associated with various mental illnesses. Neurotransmitters are chemicals. Everything in the brain is either physical or chemical. It's actually, there's no real border between the two. Chemistry is, in a certain sense, physics. So everything is physical in the brain. We believe that there are particular chemicals that are altered because simply we could measure them at the time. It was, I'm talking about the times 20, 30, 40 years ago. It was easier to measure the level of a particular chemical. And I'm now talking easier to measure in the postmortem brain, right? Because you cannot do it in the living brain. There are some methods, but they have to do with imaging and it's not direct. So we were talking about neurotransmitters and the levels because we could measure them easier. We're now talking about gene expression much more often, or even epigenetics. So what is happening above genes, what is making genes express these or the other chemicals. Because we can do it. We have now technology that allow us not only to look at the brain itself, growth picture of the brain, or a brain anatomy, using slices, staining them, looking under the microscope. This was, again, tens and tens years ago that we used these methods. Then we looked at the neurotransmitters. Now we are able to look even further into molecules, small molecules, bigger molecules, genes, how genes are structured, how they are expressed in this or that brain region. They are not expressed equally across the brain. They are expressed depending on the brain region in which they are in. Why? Because different neurons, different environment that allows or prevents them from being expressed. It's very complicated.
So what was happening with you? Your brain was swelling, it had inflammation, I guess, as a result of the immunotherapy. How did that create the kind of symptoms of mental illness that you were experiencing?
So what are the parallels with what we know about the mental illness and what happened to me? In me, it was structural because I had tumors in the brain. Swelling and inflammation were the effects of tumors mainly. And on top of tumors, I got immunotherapy, which increased inflammation and swelling. So that brain, that structural change in my brain led to mental illness because it made this part of the brain dysfunctional. The causes in mental illness are for sure different. Nobody's believes, because we would have seen it a long time ago, that there are any kind of tumors in people with mental illness. But what is similar is functional change. My functional change was the result of a tumor. Their functional change is the result of altered genes, dysfunctional proteins, or something at the molecular level which we do not fully understand yet.
So now the scariest thing is that you were not even aware that you were having these problems. I mean, these problems were serious. You were getting lost. You weren't, you know, very much like my mother. You lost the ability to even figure out how to do simple tasks that you had done before. But you thought everything was okay. Talk about that lack of insight.
Yeah, that is probably the most striking symptom that is very difficult to describe if you don't live through it. How can one who, you know, is a scientist, works in the National Institute of Health, cannot figure out how to put a seatbelt on? It is, you cannot even imagine how could it have happened. But this lack of insight is a very common symptom of people with dementia, as your mother. I had definitely a symptom of dementia, and people with mental illness. They also have no insight into their, not all of them, but many don't have insight into their illness. They don't accept that they are ill. What I felt, from my perspective, everybody else was weird. I was just as I was always. What did they want from me? I couldn't figure it out. Something was wrong with my world. Something was wrong with all these people. That's why I became very angry. And at some point, I thought they are conspiring against me. Also, that kind of paranoia that is seen in people with mental illness. I think it is because I couldn't make sense of the world and they cannot either. So I have to somehow, we like things to be systematized, to be clear, to make sense in order for us to move around and live our lives. And if it doesn't happen, then all these crazy theories are coming up.
Right. We want to make sense. If we're confused, it's more frightening. We have to make sense of the world, and we tend to make sense of it and feeling that we're being attacked. Now, what I wanted to ask you is, you went through breast cancer, stage 4. Is that right?
It was 3B, but it was pretty advanced, yes.
You went through metastatic melanoma. You went through surgery, radiation, immunotherapy. Oh, my God. And
targeted therapy also.
What was that?
Targeted therapy, which is a different type of therapy for melanoma, targeting melanoma cells. Quite toxic, I have to say. Very toxic. I describe side effects in that book.
And they're terrifying. And we also have to tell our listeners, at the same time, you were training for these, you know, marathons, Ironman marathons.
Well, that was before. When I had all these symptoms, I was still walking and running, I have to say, and swimming. I always did something, but I was not training for an Ironman anymore at this point, no. But before it all happened? Yes. After breast cancer? Yes. After skin melanoma? Yes. I was still very optimistic and full of energy.
So I just want to ask, I mean, your prognosis when you were first diagnosed with this brain tumor, this metastatic melanoma, you were given 4 to 7 months to live. Now it's been how many years and how did you survive?
So it's been a little over 3 years ago. I think all this training that I had for Ironman, I had no idea that it will serve me for survival, not an Ironman, but simply being alive. I think it helped me both mentally because it kept me active. It kept me optimistic and driven to, you know, get up from the couch, get up from the bed, go. First of all, it mobilized me to get treatment, the best treatment. I was really devoted to finding some tools for survival. And I think it is important for everybody to be in a shape. I'm not saying be prepared for this tragedy, for these tragic circumstances, but all of us will get old if we're lucky. And we may be coping with similar problems like your mother, or I did, not being able to find things. The more muscle you have, the more mental drive you have, the easier it is, I think. I have no proof for that, but that's my belief.
Barbara K. Lipska. Her book is The Neuroscientist Who Lost Her Mind. Lipska works at the National Institutes of Mental Health. In 2013, she became the director of the Human Brain Collection Core at the NIMH. She's also a marathon runner and a triathlete. Go to writersvoice.net to see a photo of Dr. Lipska on her bike and ready to ride. Next up, another neuroscientist talks about her stroke of insight, pun intended. And we hear about the farmer brigades in Puerto Rico that are helping the island recover. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Jill Bolte Taylor was working as a brain scientist at the Harvard Brain Tissue Resource Center when she suffered a devastating stroke that affected the left side of her brain. It took her 6 years to fully recover. But strangely enough, her need to depend on the right side of her brain brought her great insight into what are often hidden gifts our right brains have for us. In her memoir, My Stroke of Insight, A Brain Scientist's Personal Journey, she writes about how her stroke catapulted her into a fully right brain experience with a boundless sense of peace, the dissolution of boundaries, and a clearer channel to insight. Dr. Bolte Taylor says her experience led her to bridge the gap between spirituality and science. In this excerpt from our 2008 interview with Jill Bolte Taylor, she talks about what it was like to suffer a left brain injury and the gift of insight it brought her. Now, you were working as a brain scientist, a neuroanatomist, at the Harvard Brain Tissue Resource Center when you suffered a devastating stroke. It affected the left side of your brain. Put us there. Tell us, what were you doing when you experienced it, and what did you experience?
Well, the left hemisphere is all about language and our ability to communicate with the external world. So, and it happened the first thing in the morning when I first got up, which is quite common for stroke. And I did not know that. So I woke up and I had a pounding pain behind my left eye. And it was very pulsating. It was kind of that caustic pain that you get when you bite into ice cream. And it was just very gripping, very pulsating. So I got up and I thought, you know, I'll just start my normal routine and try to shake this thing off. And so I jumped onto my Cardioglider, which is a full-body, full-exercise machine. And I was exercising on this machine, and I looked at my hands, and I realized that my hands looked like claws grasping onto the bar. And I looked at my body, and I thought, boy, you know, I'm really a strange-looking thing, and I'd never had that perception of myself before. And it was as though I was witnessing myself having this experience on this cardioglider as opposed to being the person on the machine having the experience. So, you know, through the eyes of a neuroanatomist, the brain is my fascination. And so I was paying attention to what is this feel like? What is going on? Have I ever felt like this before? And after a little bit, I realized that I lost the boundaries of my body, of my perception of where I began and where I ended. The atoms and molecules of my body blended with the atoms and molecules of the space around me. And, you know, through the eyes of a scientist, again, this was a fascinating experience. But I had no idea what was wrong with my brain, even though I was calculating through the eyes of a scientist, trying to figure out which areas of my brain are having a problem. But it wasn't until my right arm went totally paralyzed that I realized, oh my gosh, I'm having a stroke.
Now, you say that you lost the sense of boundaries. Why was that?
Well, there's a group of cells in the left hemisphere that sets the boundary for where we begin and where we end. Did you ever wonder when you're brushing your teeth and you look at yourself in the mirror, how is it you know who you are? You know who you are because your brain is talking to you, and your brain is saying, hi, how are you? Good morning. How are you feeling today? It's how you know where you live. It's how you know your phone number. It's a group of cells that is communicating with you. There's another group of cells in that left hemisphere that are telling you the boundaries of your body so that you know you where you begin and where you end. And, you know, generally when we're just walking around, we think of the boundary of our body as where our skin meets air. But once we're in a car, studies have shown that our sense of private personal space fills the entire car so that we become essentially as large as the car. So there's a group of cells inside of the brain that are designed to define where you begin and where you end and the size of what you are. So as those cells went offline with the hemorrhage, then I lost that ability.
Now, you say that you were aware at the time, and in fact, you were really pretty interested. I found it remarkable how you were able to keep this observer. It almost seems like it was a kind of rational side. I mean, to be the observer, you have to be outside a certain boundary, and yet you were feeling boundaryless. How do you reconcile these two perceptions, these two consciousnesses that were in your brain at the time?
Well, I don't see them as separate. To me, the witness is the boundaryless and the observing, as opposed to the being and the doing. So for me, there was a shift away from one perception into another perception. But my left hemisphere didn't go totally offline until the end of the morning of the stroke, at which point then my sense of me as an individual was completely gone.
So let me try to understand this. You're actually saying that it's the part of us that's kind of immersed in the here and now that is the separate part of our consciousness, whereas
right.
The one that can witness is more connected to what unifies us with everything else?
Right.
Uh-huh. So,
yeah.
So now, your description of how you dealt with this, you just said that, you know, there was a certain point at which your brain was bleeding so much into the areas around the stroke that you began to lose more and more of the left side of your brain. I mean, you have a picture of a kind of drawing of what your brain looked like then, and it's a dark stain that covers the almost the entire left hemisphere. How were you able to function? You were alone at this time, so how
right.
were you able to rescue yourself?
Well, it was a bouncing in and out of ability to connect with normal reality. And as my left hemisphere cells were becoming inundated with blood and becoming less functional, then I would shift out into this right hemisphere consciousness into the awe and magnificence of the present moment, which was really a beautiful and captivating and inviting space. It was very seductive because it was so magnificent. And yet at the same time, then I would have these waves of clarity where all of a sudden my left hemisphere would start being functional again, and I would be able to attend to normal reality. And eventually I went into my office space because I had to come up with a plan. And 911 didn't exist for me because those where the numbers are located inside of my left hemisphere was actually right where the hemorrhage happened. So those cells were totally non-functional. And the only plan that I had was to call work. But I couldn't remember the phone number at work because that's where my numbers were, again, in that hemorrhage. So I decided I would find a business card, and I would use the business card and then in a phone, and I would call work. But I realized once I got to the business cards that I could not match the image in my mind, in my mind's eye, with the image on the card. And so I couldn't tell if the card I was looking at was actually the card that I wanted, because everything looked very pixelated, and the pixels of the background blended with the pixels of the words and the symbols, and all I could see were pixels. There was no bigger picture of, does this match what's going on in my mind? And then again, I would have waves of clarity that would bring me back to, oh, I can see, that's not the card. But it took about 45 minutes for me to get down to the card that actually was my business card for me to be able to call work.
Jill Bolte Taylor talking with Writer's Voice in 2008 about her memoir, My Stroke of Insight. Next, we talk with reporter Audrea Lim of The Nation magazine about how farmers in Puerto Rico are banding together to build resilience and fight climate change. Can farming save Puerto Rico's future? That's something climate reporter Audrea Lim went to the hurricane-savaged island to find out. Her article of that title is the first in a series for The Nation, Taking Heat. She says as climate change alters how and where food is grown, Puerto Rico's agroecology brigades serve as a model for sustainable farming. Well, thank you, Audrea Lim, for coming on to talk with us here on WPKN.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So you're doing a new series in The Nation called Taking Heat. First of all, tell us about that series.
Yeah, the series basically aims to profile different grassroots or community projects around the country that are offering like some form of a solution, I guess, to the climate crisis, but with like a justice, like racial justice, social justice, or economic justice orientation. And so some of these will be, they'll offer like alternative or like anti-capitalist models of land ownership or land management or that sort of thing.
And you have written about climate justice. So is this under the rubric of that?
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, I think there's a widespread belief that the climate crisis is about, you know, like greenhouse gas emissions, and it's largely a technical issue. And it is, you know, like all of those things are in play. But at the same time, there's been like a long history of poor or marginalized, like immigrant, Black, Indigenous communities that have really like borne the brunt of pollution, or just they're really on the front lines of the climate crisis. It's often like Indigenous lands who have pipelines coming through them. There's a long history of communities of color being sited like right near toxic like refineries or factories and facilities. And the idea behind climate justice is that in order to address the climate crisis in a meaningful way, it's important to include these justice-oriented concerns.
So talking about places that are especially vulnerable, places that have been the victims of climate injustice, you write your first post about Puerto Rico. That post is entitled, Can Farming Save Puerto Rico's Future? You start out with talking about a woman named Maga Garcia. Tell us about her and what happened to her.
Well, basically, she is a farmer in Puerto Rico. She grew up on a farm in a family of farmers, but for much of her adult life, she actually worked in the city as a social researcher. And she, there was like mass layoffs about 15 years ago in the city that she lived in. And she was, I think, in her like 40s or something at that time. And she was concerned that, you know, she's not like a knowledge worker and her career opportunities were basically declining with age. And so she thought, okay, I'm going to, maybe it's time for me to just like start growing my own food and try to live like a more self-sustainable life. But in order to do that, because she hasn't been farming for a long time, she got the help of these agroecology, like farming brigades that came and helped her to set up this piece of land for farming to, you know, like clear trees and like set up water systems and like build little roads. And without this help, it would have been very difficult for her to set up her farm on her own. And she lives currently on this farm on her own. So she's been farming for several years and then Hurricane Maria hit. And like most farms throughout the island, you know, her farm was like basically destroyed by the storm. And again, it's like with the help of these brigades that she was basically able to get the farm back on its feet. So like clearing trees and, you know, replanting things, because she is really only just, well, she lives by herself on this farm. And so these brigades, it's actually like a semi-institutionalized network of farmers around the country that are called like agroecology brigades. Some of them are, they're just different farms, little like small scale farms located around the island. And essentially when any farmer needs help with like whatever on their farm, like they want to construct a new greenhouse or they need to clear roads in like a new area of their land or something, they can put a call out to the network and say, oh, I need some help doing, you know, so-and-so. And so like on a certain day, a brigade of like other farmers, anybody who's available, and it doesn't even have to be other farmers within the network. It's like anybody on the island who wants to help, they can. So they'll just arrive to the farm on the day of and, you know, they'll like be asked to, you know, have proper gear, like be wearing proper shoes and like maybe bring some tools, also like a dish to share. And they'll all together do whatever work is necessary. And at the end of the day, usually the hosting farmer will have like a session, a teaching session, an information sharing session on whatever kind of knowledge that they have to offer. So Maga Garcia, who's like the woman in the, one of the women I profile in the piece, she plants a lot of, well, she has a lot of like fruit trees for one in her garden, but she also plants a lot of roots. So things like taro, ginger, yucca. And so the thing that she, the information or the knowledge that she was offering was about taro. So she's like harvested taro a lot from different areas of the wild because she's been planting them for a little while and like nurturing them. She, you know, knows things about like different methods that work well for them. And also one thing that she mentioned is that because of Puerto Rico's like highly commercialized food culture, I mean, in Puerto Rico, about like 85%, I think, of all of the food is imported from either like the continental United States or big box producers in Europe or Asia. And so there's like a lot of the food market in Puerto Rico is like packaged, ready-made foods from the supermarket. And so the thing that Maga Garcia was saying is that a lot of young people that she's met like don't really know much about taro. Like they don't know how to plant it, much less some of them don't have never eaten it before. A lot of people don't know how to cook it. And so, yeah, this is all part of like the information or the knowledge that she is sharing and like giving back to the people that have helped her to rebuild her farm.
Well, that's great. And just back to the brigades for a minute, you write Audrey Lim in this article, Can Farming Save Puerto Rico's Future in the Nation, that these brigades not only act as crisis support and mutual aid recovery teams, but they also facilitate adaptation and climate smart policies. What do you mean by that? And give us an example.
So one of the things about agroecology is that it's an approach to farming that like sees agriculture and like the act of farming as part of the surrounding ecosystem. And, you know, it's concerned with like the ecological impacts of like agricultural practices. And so it aims to separate itself from like the industrial monoculture approach to farming, which like dominates much of like farming in the world today. And the thing about industrial monoculture is that, first of all, often what happens is like, you know, companies will like plant one crop over a huge swath of land, and they'll do this like using inorganic fertilizers that are made up of, you know, like petrochemicals. They use like chemical pesticides and herbicides. And agroecology, by contrast, uses natural systems basically to grow crops. So some of these include things just like nitrogen fixing beans, using those instead of fertilizers, or planting flowers next to crops in order to attract certain types of like beneficial insects to manage pests, or doing like intensive planting of crops to like crowd out weeds. And so these sorts of methods, unlike the industrial monoculture method, which basically will like attempt to apply one method of growing crops or food over like vast areas of land. So agroecology, by contrast, will combine, it combines like the knowledge and skill of like the farmers who just know their land and know like the soil and the area they farm in. Those people know how everything works the best. And the idea is that this actually creates higher yields in the crops with like fewer inputs. So, you know, inputs being things like fertilizers or pesticides or even water. And it does things like it improves soil quality. It, you know, better manages pests, things like that. And so the way that I think agroecology can improve climate resilience in a couple of different ways. One is probably in the more technical sense, in that it's like a more sustainable method of farming that just doesn't, you know, that like works in concert with rather than against the local ecology. And in this way, you know, just even maintaining like soil quality, you can help to maintain like natural drainage systems that can help in times of like floods and storms. So there's that aspect of it. But like throughout the United States, there's many like the continental United States, there's lots of farmers who practice like organic or sustainable farming in the more like technical scientific sense of, which is like the more technical and scientific aspect of agroecology. But the other really important aspect of agroecology, as people I spoke to explain it to me, is the social aspect of it. So like the farmer to farmer relationships and the sharing of knowledge that, you know, like Maga Garcia's session or tutorial on like taro is an example of this. But so at a larger scale, farmers meeting with other farmers, you know, throughout the island, or even throughout like Central America or Latin America, also share information on planting methods or just observations about the changing climate. And because their knowledge is so, you know, very much tied to like the existing like land, like the condition of their land and the climate as it exists at any time, like they have to be constantly like revising their methods according to, the environment that's around them. And so a big part of agroecology is that farmers are constantly like sharing information about what's working and what they're noticing. And this is really important because it's like a constant adjustment for them to like figure out what works, basically.
So agroecology is both democratic as well as resilient. Audrey Lim, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on your Nation magazine article, the first of a series, Can Farming Save Puerto Rico's Future?
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Audrey Lim of The Nation talking about her article, Can Farming Save Puerto Rico's Future? It's the first in a series about climate justice called taking heat. Finally, one of the great perks of being producer and host of Writer's Voice is getting a steady stream of new books in the mail from publishers who want me to cover them. There's never enough time to read all the worthy books, much less bring their authors onto the show. But that doesn't mean you should miss out on hearing about some of the great titles that cross my transom, even if they're not covered here. So here are a few of the recent ones. The World Cup is going on now, so for soccer fans and others, there's Red Card by Ken Bensinger. It's a definitive, shocking account of the FIFA scandal, one of the biggest international corruption cases of recent years. It implicated nearly every aspect of the world's most popular sport, soccer, including its biggest event, the World Cup. Then ADD doctor and former Writer's Voice guest Edward Hallowell is out with a memoir. It's called Because I Come From a Crazy Family, The Making of a Psychiatrist. Hallowell is a very engaging writer with 20 books to his name, including the acclaimed Driven to Distraction, one of the earliest and best books describing what it's like to live with ADD. Simon Winchester, another guest on Writer's Voice, has just reissued his story of the making of the Oxford English Dictionary. It's called The Meaning of Everything. He also has a new book out, The Perfectionists, How Precision Engineers Created the Modern World. It's a terrific read. Finally, Carolyn Weber's book, Proust's Duchess, looks really intriguing. It's a look at the glittering world of turn-of-the-century Paris through an in-depth study of the three women Proust used to create his fictional character, the Duchesse de Guermantes. That one's going to the beach with me this summer. Meanwhile, coming up next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Elizabeth Rush about her powerfully personal look at sea level rise, Rising. It's one of the best creative nonfiction books I've read. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.